Welcome back to Progressively Incorrect. I am your host, Dr. Zach Rochelle. Today I'm excited to be bringing you the second of two DI podcast episodes that I am releasing this weekend ahead of the Progressively Incorrect Season 3 finale with Paul Kirshner. This podcast is brought to you by John Catt Educational, which publishes some of the best books in education. Since this episode is about Big DI, I thought I'd once again highlight the book Direct Instruction, A Practitioner's Handbook by Kurt Engelman. You can listen to Kurt talk about his book on Season 3, Episode 7 of this podcast. It's an excellent book and perfect for people who want the latest text on direct instruction. Now, without further ado, let's roll the tape of my interview with Casey Sovo on the Direct Instruction Podcast. Hello, and welcome back to the Direct Instruction Podcast. My name is Dr. Zach Rochelle, and today I am excited to be bringing you a fantastic episode about the role of direct instruction in teaching kids to read in Indigenous communities across America. I will be interviewing Casey Sovo, a member of the Comanche Nation, a 20-year educator, and a Bureau of Indian Education Program Administrator. Casey will speak to the incredible improvements in performance of schools that he supported when DI was implemented with fidelity, as well as the obstacles or barriers that he had to address when implementing DI. We will also talk about the times when DI was discontinued in the schools he supported, the dramatic dip in performance that followed, and the return to positive growth when schools decided to restart with DI. Overall, I was inspired by Casey's passion to eliminate the achievement gap for Indigenous students through a data-informed, all-hands-on-deck approach to teaching reading, and it was an honor to have him on the Direct Instruction Podcast. This episode is brought to you by NIFTY, or the National Institute for Direct Instruction. Registration is open for the National Direct Instruction Conference in Eugene, Oregon this summer, where in 2024, when this episode was produced, Casey Sovo will be the keynote speaker. I provided the links to register in the show notes, and I encourage you to sign up for what is the most comprehensive DI training available anywhere. If you love the DI podcast, please help me spread it around and give it a 5-star rating on the platform of your choosing. Now, without further ado, let's roll the tape of my interview with Casey Sovo. Hello, Casey. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Zach. I'm driving across North Dakota right now.
No way. What do you see outside as you're driving? Like, I've never been to North Dakota, unfortunately.
Right now, it's the beginning of a lot of farm fields. So open prairie, green grass, a little bit of a road trip for some weekend work.
Wonderful. And so let's start with this. Welcome to the DI podcast. We are super excited to sort of hear your perspective and get your story. How about you go ahead and introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Marwekan Naniyetsa Casey Sovo, Namana Tekwapa Namana Tribe, Oklahoma. Iksa Tuikana, Iksa Puraival, Tabokani, Belcourt, North Dakota, Turtle Mountain Reservation. Hello, I'm Casey Sovo. I'm from the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma. I'm also a member of the Black Knife Society of Comanche Nation. And I currently work as the superintendent for bureau-operated schools in Belcourt, North Dakota. We serve collectively 2,200 students and have approximately 550 staff members.
Excellent. And what language were you just speaking?
The Comanche, because I'm Comanche from Oklahoma. So that's my tribal affiliation. I'm also a descendant of St. Regis Mohawk from New York. And I could do an introduction in Ojibwe too, since I've been working with the Turtle Mountain Tribe for 5 years almost. I've learned a little bit of Ojibwe. So, Bojua Nim, Jinawe Magani Dug, Ogana Nagig, Indigenous. Ozwatung Inda. So, hello, all of my relations. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Ogima Nagig, which means leader of the otters. And I live in Rala, which is referred to as Oz Matung, which means the tail of the turtle.
Wow, it's amazing. How's your Tawshutse? Because that's the that's the language of the Puyallup tribe that I worked for. Did you ever learn any words from that?
No, but I should probably ask you, how's your Tawasuchi? Because you're the one who worked there.
I'm embarrassed to say that I learned a few things and I couldn't reproduce them right now. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Oh, that's a that so let's get going on this podcast. It is so nice to meet you. How let's start with this question. How did you get started in the field of education? And how long have you been involved in the education of Indigenous children?
Well, I started my educational journey way back in 1999 and full force in 2000. I've been working with the Bureau of Indian Education since 2001. But when I started growing up to become an adult, that wasn't my first career path. I jumped into a heavy science and lab program and was taking probably three lab sciences first semester. And found out once again that me and organic chemistry do not agree, and was fortunate enough to find a master's level education program where you could earn your teaching licensure while you were completing pedagogical classes and learning through actual classroom practice. So our first semester, we spent a half day on campus and a half day at our school site locations observing in-classroom teachers. Then the next three semesters, we spent kind of that same pattern, half day on campus, half day at the school site with increasing teaching responsibilities. So that our final semester, we were the teacher of record for the whole day. It was a really great program. And that's when I fell into teaching and started with Riverside Indian School in 2001 in Oklahoma, which is one of the oldest off-reservation boarding schools in our network of 183 schools spread across 23 states. By the end of my first year as a teacher at Riverside and as a teacher in general, I was learning rather quickly. There was a big mismatch between my 11th grade students and their reading comprehension abilities. So we did a data dive and started digging through transcripts that first summer to really begin to understand where our students were coming from and how they had done in school before they arrived at Riverside. We very quickly discovered that many of them had been passed forward with minimally successful grades, lots of D's and F's. A few C's and B's. Standardized test results were also very low. So they arrived in high school with not good reading and literacy skills. Fluency was problematic. Of course, vocabulary is hard when you're not fluent. Comprehension is almost non-existent if you have no fluency, and a lot of resistance to the act of reading and even the act of writing. And while I was struggling with that frustration and revelation, I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Then one of my colleagues who was working in eighth grade, who I considered to be a master teacher, we had become friends during the year. And she came over one day and to my classroom and said, you know what? I think you need to come and watch what we're doing in the middle school. I said, what are you doing that's different? Because I'm so frustrated right now. It's at the end of the year. I'm feeling like a failure. I'm not sure I made a good career choice. And I just feel like I don't have the ability to help these students. Like, I didn't go to college to learn how to teach children to read. I went so that I could teach literature and I could teach writing. And I can tell you, my 11th graders do not read on grade level. In fact, I spent almost 180 days out of the school year reading to them, just so that we could accomplish some discussion about the literature from our curriculum and try to make progress in the standards. But it was extremely frustrating, which is, yep, I don't want to hear it anymore. Pack your notebook, grab your pen, come to our meeting right now. We're meeting with our coaches. It's like, what? You have a literacy coach? What is that? Who is that? So I went and started participating in their professional development. It wasn't a requirement, but it was open to anybody on campus who was interested. And started learning about the process for teaching kids how to read, which I thought was extremely interesting and very exciting at the same time, because I was kind of noting that, like, this is what my students need. This is a skill they're missing, but now how do I teach it to them? Because I don't know it. And it began a 3 or 4 year journey at that school where we went from a very structured, multi-tier reading environment for 4th through 8th grade and spread it across the entire school so that it included 9th, 10th, and 11th plus 12th graders. And we had an alternative portion to our high school where students who were out of grade level and credit age synced could come in for a semester or two and very rapidly complete high school credits through an accelerated curriculum. So we had some even older than typical age students on campus. And we had a regional supervisor, kind of like I was for the schools around the Seattle area back in 2011 and 12, come to our campus in Oklahoma and ask us, what is the number one thing that's wrong with our school? And almost 100% of teachers and paraprofessionals said in their one-on-one time with our regional supervisor, our students can't read. And as a teacher body, we decided just to borrow the middle school's program up into the high school. So we spread multi-tiered system of support called the RTI back then. But basically, we were using some diagnostic assessments to create groups and place students on a continuum of literacy curriculums, everything from initial learning how to read strategies using programs like Reading Mastery and Corrective Reading. And we identified teachers from every content area, from every grade level of the school. Basically, if you were an adult working at the school, you got a reading group. The related arts people, the athletic coaches, the PE teachers, science, everybody for 90 minutes every single day. Some students got an additional 30. Some students got an additional 30 on top of that, just depending on the severity. And we use progress monitoring tools like a curriculum-based measure, and we charted data by hand. I mean, this was in the days before Palm Pilots, before Dibbles, before any of the convenient things that we have today that make this work much easier. We were using the Wittcock-Johnson and scoring 660 kids by hand, making sure that we were putting in the appropriate reading group, running them through multiple timed CBMs to confirm the placement, and then doing pen and paper progress monitoring every 4 to 6 weeks, just to make sure everybody's growing appropriately. And when the data warranted it and the student's confidence matched it, we would move them from group to group, progressing them as their skills grew. It was a lot of hard work, but it was so enjoyable. It helped us all to understand how important reading is in regards to the overall achievement gap and what a significant difference it makes when you can teach a child to read. We encountered adults on the staff who had a different re-engagement with school because they felt like their work was now more meaningful, more personal work. A different way to build relationship with their students than just conveying their content, trying to achieve a credit. And we also had very heartwarming stories on Florida. You know, we had some of those alternative students who were out of credit and grade level sync beg and plead to stay on campus so that they could finish their reading program because they were finally, after 13 years of school, learning how to read and getting to the eighth grade level. We had students break down in tears whenever we were trying to progress monitor them or place them for a reading booth or identify their specific needs because they would tell us, you know, this is the first time in my life any teacher has tried to help. And I always felt like I was a failure or I was not worthy because I couldn't read. And they didn't know how to help me learn to read, but you all are, and I'm going to stay at this school until I'm done. So it was very heart-engaging work. A lot of time, sweat, and tears went into that. I can remember so many nights that we would be scoring student data until 10, 11, sometimes 12 o'clock at night to get ready for the regrouping assignments on Monday when school restarted. We poured lots of professional development and training into our staff to make it happen because we know that high school teachers across the nation are not literacy teachers. They grew up and chose a content area and they expect to teach content and standards. But our school was different because we decided we would no longer swallow that pill that says it's okay for students to not be able to read. And we engaged everybody and made strong leadership support for the movement and just went full force. All students, 90 minutes a day at a minimum, all staff, all paras, virtually every adult on campus. For those 90 minutes, the only people who were available were the administrative secretaries who would answer the phones and tell everyone they'll take the message. Because we're busy teaching reading right now, we'll get back to you in 90 minutes. And
That's incredible.
yeah, and what's really crazy about it, Zach, is at Riverside, way back in 2001, 2, 3, 4, and 5, we were doing so many things that would later become a larger part of my bureau career and pieces of our work mirrored exactly what would happen in Reading First, which I joined in 2006. But I didn't know that I was using the strategies or the techniques that would be required through the Reading First grant and initiative while I was at Riverside.
It's fascinating because you made a choice, an intentional choice to address reading, which I think most people, even if they don't make the same choice, would say is really a huge part, a core mission of schools. But so many schools choose not to make that hard decision. I mean, here are some of the things I've heard, like, kids need other experiences that are just as valuable. We can't sacrifice those things for reading. Or especially when it comes to grouping, when it comes to homogeneous grouping, I hear, students will feel like they're marginalized or they're left out or that, made their self-concept is it might be affected if they're put into a lower reading group, for example. I hear a lot of those things, but then, like you said, what happens is we pass on the kids to high school, and now the teacher feels that their role is not to teach reading anymore. It's to convey the content, it's to cover the content, and then grade, I suppose, some sort of arbitrary set of, set of things that may even mask the fact they're not. We're not giving them the main gift of education, which is the ability to read. I mean, it's pretty incredible that you took those steps. What were some of the barriers you faced? I'm curious, what were some of the battles you had to wage as you went into that work?
Yeah. Early on, I didn't know I was joining the reading wars. But I'm glad that I did because it has been the most rewarding part of my career. And because of Reading First and all the research that came out of the movement to focus on early K-3 literacy, we found authors and researchers who supported our thinking and our doing. And one that stands out to me from the very beginning that really guided my personal perspective was Louisa Moats. And, teaching reading is not rocket science, but it is extremely specific. And you have to be explicit about it. Like, we as humans don't learn how to read through implicit exposure. There is a certain method, routine, or pathway you have to follow so that you can do it successfully. And when we began our work at Riverside, we encountered the whole gamut of adult responses and behaviors, from being very excited about it with some relief of, yes, finally, I've been silently crying in the desert to myself saying, reading is the most important thing and nobody's paying attention to it and my colleagues don't understand, to adults who say, it is not my job to teach reading because by the time they get to 12th grade, they should already know how to read. Or actually finding adults on staff who had very significant reading problems themselves and had done a good job of hiding them for most of their adult life. So while we were teaching the kids to read, we were also teaching each other how to be better adults and better teachers because it identified and highlighted multiple strengths and weaknesses in our instructional staff and caused us to have conversations about, well, then what is the purpose of school? Why are we here if our kids are going to come and not learn how to read or graduate and not be on grade level? What's the purpose of school? And so just foundational questions about the profession and education we had to wrestle with in our staff meetings and then offer encouragement, coaching, and support to everybody who's involved. Because we recognize that our English language arts teachers probably had the highest level of skills on staff. And we know that we had students in our mix that were ready for on-grade level work. We even had some that were ready for acceleration and extension. They were gifted, they were bright. They don't need to be held back by the majority. And we did our best to flex muscle around that so that every student got his or her appropriate placement and nothing was permanent with time, energy, and effort. So some students could learn how to read much better rather quickly. And we would move them to the next level of program, take them up higher levels of literacy, and just accelerate everyone as quickly as possible, as much as possible for the time they're with us. I think all of that work built a special kind of cohesion between the staff, instructional, paraprofessional, and residential. Because Riverside is an off-reservation boarding school, the students come there to live and stay for 180 days a year. So when we're done with education at daytime, they go back to the dormitories and spend their evenings and weekends there. So we were able to better collaborate with even the residential staff to further enhance reading practice, reading instruction, and connection to literacy. It was really eye-opening to be in those conversations and listen to evidence-based researchers put forward the evidence or the justification that would explain or contradict some things that we grew up believing. Because I wasn't a great reader as an elementary student. I didn't learn to read well until my fourth grade year. Like, I was always a member of the lowest reading group, the worst looking bird. I was in the buzzards group, the blackbirds group, the crows. However, the teachers broke them down and named them for the first 4 years of school, I was in that low group. It didn't click for me until I had reading with my fourth grade teacher. I was a kid who struggled with looping and swooping from one line of text to the next. And I would constantly reread the same line over and over, not realizing that I'm saying the same words out loud and not progressing down the page. And I had bookmarks and I had highlighters and we had colored paper, all of the kind of instructional supports that were recommended, but it wasn't making a difference until my fourth grade teacher came along. And she must have had a different set of literacy skills because she helped me put the pieces together in a meaningful way. And having been a student like that, I could identify with the struggles that our students were having, regardless of grade level. Because it's really horrible to not be able to read as a student in the older grades. And I think adults were just too comfortable with blaming the student for his or her inability. When in reality, when we dug through the data and the transcripts, we learned that more than likely they suffered from miseducation or dysteachia. Miseducation, meaning they just were not given a great education wherever they had gone to school before they came to us. Dysteachia, meaning they were actually taught wrong before they came to us. So they had misconceptions galore in reading and writing and math because they had been allowed to pass through their previous schools on D's and F's with high absenteeism rates. So they probably weren't even present for a good portion of school. And we know now, based on the body of evidence and research over the last 20 years, when you have a high absenteeism record in grades K through five, the rest of your school age experience is going to suffer because you've missed huge chunks of knowledge and skills and abilities that help you to do well in school, help you to be successful with the learning tasks of school in the higher grade levels.
I hear now that you are going to be the keynote speaker of the Nifty conference in Eugene this summer. So I think it's quite an honor. It's pretty amazing. Let's talk about maybe the DI stuff specifically. How did you learn about direct instruction? Like when you sort of mentioned it, but when did it come into your consciousness, and sort of how did you start getting it into schools?
Well, my experience with scripted programs started at Riverside Indian School, but these were not big DI programs because we used a lot of Michael Maloney in the beginning and some Anita Archer vocabulary instructional programs, the science and the social studies. We didn't move into big DI programs until I moved to join the Bureau of Indian Education's Reading First office in 2006. And it was reading mastery, corrective reading. Those were two of the programs that were on our list of approved programs that Reading First grantee schools could choose from based on their data and their need. So in 2006, I actually had to go and learn how to teach reading mastery and corrective reading, how to coach it, and began attending workshops and presentations. I've been to NIFTY conference in the summertime, probably 3 or 4 years in a row, and we were doing our Reading First grant work. And I was assigned a collection of schools, sometimes working with as many as 20 or 29, I think, where they had selected reading mastery and corrective reading to be their replacement to the core program because the instructional need was so large and their RTI triangle was flipped upside down. And it was more like everyone at the school needed targeted, specific, explicit instruction. So a big box program, a comprehensive core literacy program, was not going to do those students justice because They hadn't even learned the foundational skills of learning how to read. They had huge holes in their five big five, be it phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, comprehension, vocabulary. It just wasn't there. And so many schools decided to use direct instruction as the replacement to the core program and as a pathway to get to a big box literacy program in the future. And big box, I mean something like Houghton Mifflin and Harcourt, Voyager, Storytown, Scott Foresman. I don't remember all of the titles for them these days, but we never really looked at direct instruction as the only means to the end. It was a step stone for continuous growth and achievement of students. But through our reading first initiative, that's when I got my first initial and deep exposure in reading mastery, directed reading, through attending NIFTY conference and regional reading mastery and corrective reading training sessions and workshops, and getting to know some of the consultants who are working in our schools. Being on campus when they were providing service was time for me to learn as well, because the consultants we hired back then, or schools hired, were recommended through the NIFTY network. These were people known in the DI community who also wanted to work with our schools around the Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, schools up and down the West Coast in Oregon, Washington, California. Practically at a school every single week that schools were in session. You're traveling 4 weeks out of every month and 9 months out of every year. And then the summertime would be filled with our own professional development so that we could be better coaches to the schools. We could be better technical assistance providers, better users of the data and the body of data that we're building, so that we could understand how literacy skills and student achievement were changing over time because of our efforts.
It's interesting you said you started with the idea that reading mastery and corrective reading, which are big DI programs, would just sort of be like a stepping stone to these other kind of basal readers. Some of them you listed, would be now associated with sort of balanced literacy. And it started like that. I mean, over time, working with the programs, did you see, what sort of changes in the performance of children did you see when DI was implemented with fidelity?
Over time, we saw huge academic gains, almost complete reversals of no growth to negative growth to now moving in a very positive upwards to the right kind of direction if you're looking at it on the coordinate plane. And year over year, schools were gaining anywhere between 5 to 15 percentile points in third grade reading achievement. By year two, year three, year four of implementation, their third graders, when you sit down and test them on, I think it was the SAT-10 back then, you just see this phenomenal growth. And you're like, what is attributing to this? Well, it's the fact that their K-1 and two teachers are teaching their students how to read. And while we went in with the intent of using DI as a stepping stone, schools learned in years two and three of their implementations that it doesn't have to be a stepping stone. They don't have to leave it if they don't want to. And it was about the time that Reading Mastery was becoming a comprehensive core program. They were rounding out the literature and the writing components so that it could be on par and in direct competition with the traditional big box programs. So we would help schools negotiate that choice. We never told them that you must leave direct instruction behind or that you should choose something else every 3 years, because once a school got to a system of literacy instruction that was working for their community and their students, we would very quickly say, if it's not broke, don't fix it. We'll just continue on because the underlying Well, one of the underlying root causes in communities that we have schools is lack of Head Start, lack of pre-K. And if you know anything about Indian country and the history of Indigenous people in the United States, you know that their relationship with westernized educational systems has been problematic and deadly since before the 1800s. So there's a lot of historical trauma bound up in communities, and educational trauma still exists. It's been passed down from great grandparents into current day students because of the boarding school era, the missionary school practices, the parochial school histories. I mean, Indian country's relationship with formal education has been difficult and a battle from day one because it's, in many people's eyes, contrary to how Indigenous people would have raised and taught their children in a traditional tribal setting. And so we had to deal with that when we're working through implementation questions and reviewing data and trying to understand, what's the next step for the school after 3 years of practice? And helping them to explain their choices based on student data and support those too. So if they found that direct instruction program worked well for them and it was great for their teachers and their students, then let's stay with it. You don't have to.
It's interesting. I'd like to dig into what you just said because I've heard this a few times. Because you just talked about generational trauma and sort of a the relationship between Indian country and sort of Western formal education like institutions. And so like I think it's easy to maybe a little bit lazy, I think, to say that. Because direct instruction and other scripted programs are formal or for are very formalized and very teacher led, that it's not appropriate for indigenous communities that maybe an implicit way would this is just what other people have said. This is not what I believe, but that it would maybe that would be better for these communities, and but. That's not what you experienced, and it's not. I wonder if you had to grapple with that line of thinking when going towards more explicit based, teaching systems that you implemented in these schools.
Absolutely. And I had to re-struggle with that just 3 years ago. As you can probably tell, I'm not one who ascribes to the belief that reading is an implicit activity. By watching someone else read, then you can learn to read too. I think that's a load of hogwash. If you're going to learn to read, you must be explicitly taught how to identify the letters and the sounds that they make and the combinations of those sounds to form words and the formation of words into bigger words, read them all fluently so that you can build comprehension. No, that's the science of it. And if you don't do that right, if you don't have someone tell you how to do that and give you ample practice and correct your errors with support, then you're not going to learn how to read. I don't care what program you use. I would agree with you, it's a lazy assumption by adults who think that that's what they're doing when they're using a big box program that was written for the 50th percentile or higher and disregarding their students' incoming data on whatever grade level. What we found through our implementations is that on any given grade level in Reading First and BIU Reads, students were coming to school at minimum two grade levels behind in K1, 2, and 3. How can you use a program written for the 50th percentile achiever in third grade if you're two grade levels behind, meaning you have skills like a first grader when you are still learning, excuse me, how to read? You've just gone beyond simple decodable text. in third grade, you're supposed to be getting ready to transition to read to learn, not learn how to read.
And I'm sure, from what I've heard, the DI was discontinued in some of the schools that, you supported. And then also the implementation restarted in some schools. I'm curious, did you see any patterns as you looked at the data from schools that discontinued and then restarted and so on, that you would say were interesting or that the audience would like to hear, would like to know about?
Yeah, for this audience in particular, the pattern after discontinuation was a return to low student achievement. Because unfortunately, what we've seen in multiple initiatives inside the DIE is when funding stops, or when the grant is over, or the initiative ends, so then do the practices. Because there's typically not an external force above the school driving the practice forward, holding the school accountable, saying, in some ways, you took the money, you have to do the work. Well, now there's no more money to support the work, and people drift back to their comfort zone. And it's usually a drift backwards to past practices that were not as effective as the explicit practices they had during the initiative. So what I remember is student achievement dropping in those schools that dropped DI programs and stopped using multiple tiers of instruction and tried to go back to what they felt was best for everyone. In my heart of hearts as a teacher, what's best is exposure instead of explicit teaching. Let's just be honest. Explicit teaching takes a lot of time, energy, and effort by the adult. You have to plan, you have to prepare, you have to practice. And not all instructional programs require that. If you want to be good at DI and you want to make it lively and engaging, that's an extra element that's not present in the books. It doesn't say smile and be happy and then start your lesson. But you can certainly approach the instruction materials with a deadpan face and a monotone voice and all of this adult frustration that says, I don't like this program. I hate the fact that I got to teach it. I wish you were doing something different. That sends bad messages to students. They pick up on that right away. And it's really problematic because learning how to read is less about the adult and more about the student. Because what we would say to our schools is what you're going to select based on your data is about the students, not your adults. So we're not going to help you find a program that you like because it makes you feel good as an adult. You already know how to read. You may choose not to read for pleasure. You may choose not to read for information, growth, and development, but you do know how to read. And for students who haven't had that opportunity to learn how yet, we know that this DI program or pathway is going to be the shortest, fastest way to close the achievement gap. We can make 1, 2, 2.5, maybe even 3 years growth in 1 year of practice with strong fidelity. And in most cases, that means two lessons a day and then some. That's a high level of commitment because then you have to start borrowing time from the rest of the elementary curriculum. And that's where we get into those conversations with teachers with, yes, but what about science? What about music? What about art? What about social studies? Which I would counteract with, if you can't read, how are you going to master those texts as well? So it becomes a chicken or the egg kind of conversation for some, but it always requires an adult decision that says literacy is first, the rest of school is second.
It's I'm feeling two ways right now listening to this. Like the first part of what I feel like is how inspiring a lot of what you've just told is in terms of the work that I'm doing, the work that many of us that are listening are doing. We want to bring The right to read to every student, regardless of their background, regardless of where, their home life and all these other excuses people have for failing to teach kids to read. On the other hand, I hear just a lot of barriers, it's a struggle. You mentioned one, which is interesting, which is that the teacher needs to teach. And, that might not be in every, everybody's favorite. It might not be everybody's favorite thing to do. On the other hand, right, me teaching with the DI programs, it's empowered me. It's given me so much of I see the success in the students, and it gives me the motivation to come in every day and accelerate them. I think as people listen to this podcast, they're just going to keep asking that question. Why not? Why do people keep abandoning DI? Why isn't it more widespread? And what's going on here? Maybe you could touch, maybe what are your thoughts on that? What are your theories on that, those questions?
Honestly, I don't know why people abandon DI, because it was so successful in our schools and for our students. And once you learn how to do it and you learn your program, you basically don't have to do anything else. The creativity that teachers say they want and they thrive upon is more about personality than real creativity, even regardless of program. When I'm going in and doing classroom observations, when teachers are being given the freedom to do what they want, to be creative, to choose, I still see it as personality, and some people have that energy and the passion and the drive for it. We're saying put that into DI. And the real struggle for me always comes back to adults putting themselves second behind the needs of their students. And in our communities, at our schools, we have a greater need for that to be understood in practice, because we have a high transition rate in a lot of our schools. Students might come for the first of school, but they leave after the first 9 weeks, the first semester, because family and life situations change. And now they have to go and live another part of the reservation. They're living with a different family member, or they're moving to another town. So we may not have them for the entire school year, or they do move away and they come back again later. And some of them do that 3 or 4 times in a given school year. For us, using a direct instruction program and being explicit and on target and on cue, using student data to understand exactly the skills that they were mastering and being able to prove based on the data, this child has mastered this skill, which was something that I don't think many of our teachers could do, regardless of program they were using prior to starting Reading First or BIE Reads. When you ask for the evidence of mastery, how do you know that your students mastered this skill? It was hard for them to define and describe. Not really strong evidence-based measures. It would more like, I feel, I think. It's like, well, show me the data. And that becomes the conversation stopper right then and there. Like I said earlier, I recently had this conversation with one of my schools in North Dakota, because they were deciding whether or not they would be using a direct instruction program just 2 years ago. They were struggling with the big box that they had bought. Their student data was far below expectation. Their triangle was very much upside down. Everybody at school needed intensive literacy instruction. And right out of COVID, we'd already spent 2 years of at-home, distance, virtual instruction. And, it's beyond me how kindergarten, first and second grade teachers were able to virtually teach reading instruction during that time. But my elementary school was just struggling. What are we going to use? Because what we bought doesn't match the need. And we have this other thing called reading mastery in the closet. And I walked in on their meeting where they're deciding those, listened for a little bit and I said, well, what do you mean it's in the closet? And they're like, oh, we have piles and piles of it. We bought it, you know, several years back. We used to use it. And I said, I know you used it in Reading Mastery whenever you were in the Reading First project. And you all were one of the highest flying schools then. And they're like, yeah, but we stopped using it after the grant and people went back their own ways. And now it looks like we need to use it again, but I don't think our teachers are going to be very happy about it. I don't think they're going to like it. And me being the supervisor over the school, I said, it's not about you, but it is about those students. And if they need it and you have it, that's what we're going to do. And I don't care if you don't like it. We didn't come to school to teach the things that we like. We come to school to teach the things that our students need.
I mean, it's, I'm laughing nervously. It's like, geez, and it's such a similar thing to my story where what do we have for intervention materials? And everyone says, everyone just kind of pulls it out of thin air and Googles it. And I open up a cupboard one day and find corrective math and corrective reading, gathering dust. And I go, what about these? Same answers. Like, I don't, yeah, I don't know. And goodness, and it set me off on the journey that I am now, and now I'm able to speak to you. Casey, I'm so honored that you would come on to the podcast. Let's end with this. What are your hopes for the future of Indigenous education? What are you working on now? And for listeners, I'm sure they're curious about what kind of journey you're on at the moment.
Right now, my journey with the five schools that I work with is building K-12 alignment, so curricular, instructional standards. We're very heavy into our multi-tiered system of support model. We have all kinds of student data, you know. Universal screeners, diagnostic, progress monitoring. We probably have the largest body of teachers, instructional coaches, and paras who understand the importance and relevance of all of those things more than ever before. And it has been an ongoing battle and kind of sort of circus, enjoyable because it feels like so much from the past. It's like a blast from the past, back to the future. It's Reading First all over again with a brand new set of people, some of them veterans from those Reading First BID Reads initiative days. It was like, oh yeah, I was here. We did that. It worked really good. And then we stopped doing it. I don't know why, but leadership changed. And then the direction of instruction changed. And I'm just a teacher, so I had to go with it. I said, well, welcome back to the future. We're going to do it again because that's where I was born and bred. And it's exciting because we've taken what we did in elementary and spread it to the middle school and spread it to the high school. So we have tiered instruction, explicit direct instructional programs for English Language Arts and reading, plus math for middle school and high school. And we've grouped students. We give them additional doses as needed. And we've, for the first time in our history, started seeing advanced level students on the summative annual assessment. And our growth rates, compared to the rest of the state, are phenomenal. For 3 years in a row, my middle school has exceeded the growth rate average of the state in both ELA and math. Our proficiency scores are inching up by 5 and 10 percentile points on an annual basis. And staff in both are able to now collaborate and coordinate with science and social studies, so that they're all starting to see literacy as really a campus-wide initiative. And mathematics is coming in hard behind that because we realize we need additional support, professional development, training, and instruction for math. And a lot of that is for our math teachers, especially in the elementary age. So, what is my hope and my dream? That one day there will not be an achievement gap for Indigenous children at schools in America. And for the schools that I lead, we're working on that right now. We're not waiting for one day because I tell them it's us. We're the ones in charge of making that dream a reality. We are the ones that our ancestors were praying for. We are the ones that our leaders dreamed about. So it's about us taking action now, making decisions now, and learning to do things that may be uncomfortable, may be challenging, may be hard. But our kids, our most valuable asset, the most important feature of our tribe, are the ones who need this. So there are days when you have to put your big boy pants on or your big girl pants on and come to work because we are protecting the future of the nation, the future of the tribe, and the future of the community through education. And if not us, then who? And if not now, then when?
With that, Casey Savo, thank you so much for coming on the Direct Instruction Podcast. I wish you the very best with your keynote this summer. I just really just so honored you'd come on. Thank you so much, Casey.
I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to the nifty keynote, although I am almost scared stiff, as I'll get to speak to people who mentored and trained me and hopefully inspire and educate those who attend the conference to get the same level of motivation that I have when I talk about theirs. Thank you for your time, Zach. I really enjoyed it. And we'll be in touch.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.